And the tiled bar and the marble floor and these wonderfully sort of defined areas still left in there, things like the working man's dining room. Because the marble floors so you could go in your work boots. My grandfather used to go there, because my grandfather was a docker, Di Roberts. And all the dockers, they would get their pay on, they would just troop out and straight into the Waterloo. And then my grandmother would send my mother down to get some of the money off him before he'd actually drunk it all. And she would have to knock on the door and go, "Is Di Roberts in there?" And these people would go, "Di, is your daughter?" And they'd come out, because it would be a great embarrassment then, because obviously his daughter had come down to get the money.
So what was this about? Why make these pubs so ornate? Often you got the owners of these pubs trying to outdo each other. You know, you get one brewery produce one with a fine interior, and then a rival brewery would go a little bit further.
Do you think it helped in beer sales or not?
Clearly, they hope to attract more customers, and I'm sure it did.
The beauty of these pubs was partly why people took them to heart. In many predominantly working class areas, little thought was given to making something beautiful, purely for everyone to enjoy.
They got away from home because the conditions were bad. They'd been hard at work. Most of them had got big families. And I think they got into the pub to forget all the troubles.
Huge populations all kind of did the same sort of jobs at the same time. It was a very regimented existence, obviously, so people would work together. They'd come out of the factories and the mines, and they'd want to play together, so they would all go to the same pubs. Everyone knew each other, everyone knew the landlord, everyone knew each other's names.
In the West Midlands, what they commonly call the black country there, but it's all a manual labour sort of a thing. There's hard working chaps. Well, that was their enjoyment. If they could get in the booze of a weekend, congregate together, that's what they enjoy.
I remember going to a pub opposite the steelworks in Redcar, and at 5 to 6, the barman started pulling pints, and the entire length of this long bar was covered in pints of beer. At 6 o'clock, the whistle blew, and this vast flood of men came out of the steelworks into the pub, and the beer just disappeared in one gulp and was immediately replenished, because they'd been working for 8 hours in the most amazingly grueling hot atmosphere.
Satisfying, you know. You're satisfied. You have a good drink, you have good company.
The Germans call beer liquid bread. And I've always thought that's a wonderful description of beer, because it is exactly that. It's made from very much the same ingredients that go into bread making, apart from the hops, of course, but you're using grain and you're using yeast. And certainly, for a very long time, beer was seen as a staple part of the British diet.
Those golden age beauties are still some of the most beloved pubs in Britain. But when the spectre of war loomed, they faced real threat. In the First World War, that wasn't just from physical destruction. There was also strict regulations in place. Restricted hours, nationalisation of pubs and breweries, even no treating rules, so you couldn't stand your mate for a pint, let alone get around him. Pretty bad for a local and national morale. But by the Second World War, the thinking was very different.
The pub was a symbol of British life and what we stood for, and it was a symbol of a way of life that was under threat. And so long as the pub was open the morning after a bombing raid or whatever, it showed that we hadn't been beaten, it showed that we were still going. And this is why you had bomb sites where you would have a landlord getting two beer barrels and putting a plank over the top of them and opening for business.
And my first experience as a tiny, tiny baby in World War II was being smuggled into a pub in Norfolk. My mother would put me under the bench. And it was, she wasn't a heavy drinker. She hardly drank at all, but it was the only place to go to. Everywhere was blacked out. You couldn't have lights. There were no cinemas in small towns or villages, so people went to the pub.
A pint was so important to wartime morale that Spitfires and Hawker Typhoons were used to fly British Ale to mobile pubs on the front line. Reviews were mixed, though. Decent beer, a bit too much engine oil in the aftertaste. I think you know what I'm saying. And on VE Day, the nation's public houses became the site of legendary parties. Post-war just for people wanting to embrace life again. Restore some of the gentler pastimes lost in the brutality of war.
The inns of England retain much of their old world atmosphere and are still the places where ordinary people most naturally come together. One of their oldest attractions has recently been revived, busking in its highest form. And a talented company of amateur strolling players, known as the Taverners, are going from house to house giving full-length classical plays. Here they are in the middle of Sheridan's The Rivals at a public house in Bromley. From the applause of the audience, the play was a great success, and a pleasant change from the usual round of darts and conversation. And stepping down from the Empyrean heights of drama, when all was over, the actors themselves showed that they too were but human, and that a drink well earned is a drink doubly enjoyed.
Post-war saw a massive societal shift. The pubs that survived or had been rebuilt after bombings, they needed to evolve. Once a staunchly masculine place of respite was now a place for women, many of whom had found some independence and daring during wartime.
The contemporary pub is the mixed pub, and no pubs are built now where women do not have a place. And the results? Carpets, upholstered comfort, wood carvings, coquetry. Four feminine seas of civilization. The pint tankard, though not replaced, is outnumbered by the daintier stemmed glass.
One tad. Oh, well done, Axel.
Wife don't come, the husband won't come, you see.
Yeah.
But in this club we've every facility for the wife to be where she wants, the husband to go with her. Your wife may be here, for instance, and I may treat her or treat her sister or something like that.
How many years have you been playing darts?
10 years.
Have you? All the time?
All the time, yes.
How did the club start?
Well, we used to sit in this lady's room, drinking, and we were very lonely. The men were all in the bar. So we decided we'd form a ladies' dance team. And ever since, it's been a great success.
There was a wealth of new people coming to Britain in the rush to rebuild homes and industry devastated by the war, particularly from Commonwealth countries. But not everyone received the welcome British pubs are famous for. Actually, it was quite the opposite.
So it's Desi. And it's like rhymes with messy. That's the best way to do it. So aim for Lionel Messi and say Desi.
What does Desi mean?
So Desi is a Sanskrit word for the homeland. In this case, it refers to India. But it can also mean a group of people. Desi could be people who have left India and are living in other countries like England. So I'm a Desi.
What does a Desi pub mean?
A Desi pub is a pub that was set up by people of Indian origin, Desis, to have a safe space to drink in a time when they couldn't have that. In the time of segregation, in the time of the colour bar, or in the time of exclusion and racism. So I think it's really important that the term is linked to this idea of racist struggle. You could say simplistically a Desi pub is a pub run by someone of Indian origin, but then a Wetherspoons could be run by, or a Fuller's pub, or a chain pub could be run by someone of Indian origin. But I think a Desi pub has that history, but also it's about stamping our identity onto that pub.
That was from the food programme in 2026. People faced a lot of racism as they made the UK their home. If you weren't white, you couldn't live on certain streets. You might be made to do the hardest or the dirtiest work in the foundries or the docks. And some pubs instituted a colour bar, stopping people coming in at all, or confining them to a separate, often uncomfortable room.
And we're outside of the Blue Gates Hotel.
Yeah.
Why are we here?
So the Blue Gates is quite a famous pub. It's famous for the fact that when Malcolm X came to Birmingham in 1965, he came because he knew that there was a lot of kind of conflict about particularly Asian men who worked in the foundries here. One, not being allowed into many pubs, and two, being just restricted to certain areas of those pubs. And this is a very iconic pub because Malcolm X walked alone to Marshall Street, where they had this campaign. The locals had a campaign not to rent their houses to Asian people, and it was a very racist campaign to keep the area, keep that street white. And so Malcolm X went there, and he, you know, he received a lot of hostility afterwards. He fancied a drink. So he and Abtar Jowell, who was one of the main kind of agitators who brought him here, went into this pub. He was refused service. So this became really iconic for Malcolm X's visit, because just a few days later, he was shot dead in America.
But hate is very bad for business, and communities fought back.
You can't make profits if you're barring half your clientele. So many of them went out of business or were boycotted. I mean, this was a massive campaign, by the way. You know, it's like if pub landlords would, when they reapplied for their licenses, agitators would go to court, to the magistrate's court, and say, no, they shouldn't, they're racists. And also, I think gradually, as the economy of the West Midlands really suffered from deindustrialization, and this is the really crucial bit, a lot of these pubs actually went out of business. So in this area, the cultural impact is this. Some of these pubs are gradually taken over by Asian men, mostly Punjabi entrepreneurs. Initially, they started as sort of like bit of a dive, you know, you go in, there was some food available and so on and so forth. And they were mostly for Asian men. This is a really happy story. What's happened is they've now evolved into an absolute heart of the community.
What's really important is when the pubs became Desi pubs, when we became more of a welcoming, inclusive country, white people started going to Desi pubs, and they started to integrate with Asian people. Which this idea of integration is always like, how will Asian people integrate with white people? Well, actually, Smethwick shows what white people are like when they stay in their area, see it change for the better, and do all that dirty work of multiculturalism that politicians like to talk about, but never ever realise.
Industrialization saw the evolution of the pub as a place that could bring everyone together. But as time passed, places built on factories and mines, well, they saw rapid change. The neighborhoods where workers lived were demolished at scale. But the pubs that were their cornerstone refused to go quietly.
I'm standing in Chapel Street in Hankey Park, which is part of Salford in Lancashire. 4 years ago, they started to pull down Hankey Park, and the families have moved out to the new housing estates on the outskirts of town. All that's left is a wilderness of rubble and weeds, with just 10 buildings left standing. 10 buildings that used to be very important to the 4,000 people who lived here in Hankey Park. The pubs.
Pubs like the Miner's Arms, the Nelson, the British Queen, the Druid's Rest, the Foresters, the Victoria, the Grove House, the King's Arms, the Joiner's Arms, and the Wellington Hotel. 10 oases in a desert of brick dust and cinders. Real oases. Because these pubs are not only still standing, but they're still open. For 4 years, somehow, the beer's been kept flowing. But not for much longer, because now, finally, the pubs are coming down.
This was replicated across the country. There was parts of London, Manchester...